Making the world a better place, one show at a time. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. All right.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
Okay. All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio, straight out of the city of Chicago. And we are reeling from this attack in Manchester, England. It is just awful. Ariana Grande concert. I mean, I believe she finished her concert and this, you know, happened. And, you know, this is just crazy. I think 20 young people died. These are all teenagers, young children, and 15 to maybe, I don't know, 20, 24. They were all young girls from the reporting I'm hearing. And this is just awful. Terrorist attack. And ISIS, as you probably have heard, ISIS is taking the blame for this, even though there is no proof of ISIS having anything to do with this, but somehow they're taking the blame. They're saying it was them who did this. Well, if it's, whether it was ISIS or not, just by them taking the blame or wanting the blame for it, and they enjoyed this kind of thing, you know, I mean, they should be destroyed. Yeah, well, I know Obama's bombing terrorist attacks over in Syria and Afghanistan, but somehow it's just not enough. You know, Obama has bombed and Trump is bombing, but this is ridiculous. The world is sick. The world has gone crazy. And some people are saying the world is not sick. It's the people. I have to agree with that. I think it is the people, because the people are of the world. There is just no remorse. And they've caught this guy. He's in custody. You know, obviously a Muslim. And I believe they're looking for some other person, some other guy. It's just awful that they're showing clips of this now on the news and to my left. But it's just awful, people. It's just terrible that people are just so careless and callous and mean and honorary and uncaring. And it's not over. I mean, these guys are going to be, I mean, and they feel like martyrs after they kill so many innocent people. I think they're cowards. I think anybody go out there and just kill innocent people for no good reason at all is a coward. Totally a coward. And a lot of the sports stadiums around the country, around the United States, they're adding more security to their venues because of this. And I can't blame them. I can't blame people for adding more security around their venues because of this. You know, I mean, it could happen anywhere to anybody at any point at any time. It is totally ridiculous that this world is just so mean and cruel and killing innocent people. Killing innocent people pointless, endless attacks, bloodthirsty terrorists. It's just, I don't know, man. It's just not right. What can I say to the George Wilder Jr. Show? Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. It's a sad note. There's no doubt about it. And it's just awful what's going on in the world and how our politicians, you know, put tape and bandage on this situation, but they do not do anything to try to get these terrorists out of the country, out of the, you know, kill them or do something. You know, I mean, these terrorists are just terrorists. And this is just sickening, sickening all the time. Every time you look around, there's a terrorist bombing, taking innocent people's lives. And that's one of the things that terrorists like. They like to kill people in massive numbers. You know, it has to be in massive numbers, you know. Wow, this is crazy. Even though they got the guy, I'm pretty sure he's not remorseful for what he's done, the lives that he has taken. I'm pretty sure he's nowhere near remorseful. And he probably would do it again if he wasn't caught. So thank God for him being caught. And from my understanding, this guy is no stranger to the police, police in England, or the police in general. Then you say to yourself, why was he out on the damn streets in the first place? Wow, this is just crazy. It's nutty. Then we got Donald Trump. How nuttier and crazier can it get around here? I mean, how? You know, it's just unbelievable, totally unbelievable. All right, my guest today, or my guest scheduled for today to be on the show, is Dale Stanton. Okay, that's we'll see what that's going to be about. And I'm still reeling from a lot of this. And another sad note I want to say for today, James Bond. We had a death in the James Bond family, 007. Yeah, Roger Moore. He was the longest. He of all the James Bonds, of all the actors who played James Bond, Roger Moore made the most movies. For some reason, I was thinking it was Sean Connery who made the most Bonds. But I think Sean Connery made 6 Bonds. Roger Moore made 7. Of course, Pierce Brosnan was 4. And some guy, he did 2. But it was Roger Moore who made the most Bonds. Even though a lot of people don't realize, Roger Moore was a successful actor before he even became Bond, before they even asked him to play Bond. And one of the things about Roger Moore's Bond that's contrast to Sean Connery's Bond is that Roger Moore played James Bond in a comic sense. He was very humorous as Bond, whereas Sean Connery was, he was serious. There was no humor in his Bond. But, you know, you got people who are still saying today that Sean is their favorite Bond. Then there's people who say Roger Moore was their favorite Bond. But you hardly ever hear anybody say Pierce Brosnan, which I think Pierce Brosnan was a pretty good Bond. Daniel Craig. I think the first movie that he done, that he played as Bond, was probably his best. The other three were so-so. So I'm still saying that Daniel Craig is, in my view, from my point of view, is not the best Bond. I think he would probably fall in third place. Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan, you know, Daniel Craig is third or fourth, you know. So that's just my opinion. That's just my thoughts. Other people probably got other things to say. 347-857-1762. Britain increases threat level to critical after terror attack in Manchester, England. Can you blame them? Can you blame them? You know, I mean, I think everybody around the world are on alert with this thing. It's just happening too much. It's just happening too damn much around here. Wow. All right. The negative thoughts that enter your mind don't mind entering if you don't mind. I just love that little saying there because it's great. And be kind to one another. It's so easy. Obviously, the terrorists are not being kind to anyone. They just love blowing things up, blowing themselves up, blowing other people up. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I don't think anybody, no leader, United Nations, a lot of these guys, and girls haven't found a way to eradicate this earth of ISIS or radical Muslim groups in general. Even some of the gangbangers in the city of Chicago, on the south and west sides of Chicago. And that's another talk for maybe later on in the show, because we are having a lot of problems in the city of Chicago when it comes to politicians and the state of Illinois. So, it seemed like just troubles are just everywhere, all over. And everything is just against the middle class, the poor. People pissing on the middle class. Folks pissing on the poor. It's just people who can't fend for themselves, people who don't have a voice for themselves, people who are uneducated and can't really articulate their feelings or their talents the way a lot of us can, because, you know, we have the tools to do that and they haven't. But it's just a shame that the poor and the middle class are just being, you know, thought of as nothing around here. But the George Wilder Jr. Show would never think that of anyone. I don't care if you're poor, rich, or whatever. Everybody has a talent, and everybody should use that talent to make something of themselves. So you don't have to depend on the government. So you don't have to, you know, rely on reckless and lying and rotten politicians to make your life better for you. You're going to have to start making your own life better. These guys are about to step on you. And with Trump's budget, 2018 budget, it is nothing but a gift to the rich. That's all it is, disguised as helping the poor and the middle class. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the show. But we're going to, let's see what we're going to do. We did Ashley Judd, and she was great. I love it. I found the clip. So, you know, we're going to do that every now and then, but we'll be right back. One of my computers are malfunctioning, and I don't think it's the internet itself. I think it's just a computer that's acting up. You know, sometimes your computer, I mean, you know, when your computer is out or is down, you know, seems like your life has just been sucked out of you because you don't have your computer. You don't have a way to get your message or what you're saying or what you're doing out to the world. And they have no way of getting into you unless they call, of course. But, okay, back to this thing that happened, this terror attack that happened in Manchester, England. Okay, police also they've arrested a 23-year-old as part of their investigation. Islamic State militant, they call him, group claim responsibility for the bombing in a statement released today, which is Tuesday, at the broadcast of this show. Okay, you might podcast this show, and it might say Tuesday, and it may not be Tuesday, but you know you're listening to a podcast of the show. Although it isn't clear whether the terrorist group had any direct role in planning the attack. That's what I was just saying at the beginning of the show. ISIS says that it's responsible for the terrorist attack in England, but there is no proof of that. You know, it could come later, you know, the proof could come later. But as of now, from what I understand, there's no proof of that. But anyway, we do know that there's over 20 something people dead. And there is a videotape of people fleeing the stadium, stomping, probably a stampede. When a stampede of people are trying to get out of a venue, that's dangerous. Of people being stepped on, run over, you know, it's just awful. I was going to say awful. It's just awful, you know. So. It's a mess, but we got to do something. I'm going to still advocate on this show, making the world a better place, because that's what it's all about. It's all about making the world a better place, no matter how hard it may seem, no matter how useless sometimes it may seem and may appear. But nothing, you shouldn't give up on it. Yeah, I do believe that it's the people that we have to get to change their hearts. We have to change their hearts. And some people, you cannot change their hearts. They're criminals, they're thugs, and that's what they're going to be. But some people, you can probably change their hearts. You know, look at yourself, make that change. Man in the Mirror, Michael Jackson. I mean, that's one of my favorite songs by the guy, but if you listen to the lyrics and you hear what the song is saying, you would probably make it one of your favorite songs too, you know, because if you want to make the world a better place, the best place to make that change is in yourself. If you feel that you are the one who are standing in the way from making the world a better place. And that's what this show is all about, is making the world a better place, no matter how hard it seems, no matter what happens, no matter what happens to make it appear that it's a waste of time, and it's not a waste of time. It's not a waste of time. You know, anytime you can change somebody's heart, anytime you can make a difference in someone's lives, no matter how small, how minute, or whatever, that's a win-win. It's something to, work on. It's something to work from. And, you know, we're going to keep trying that. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Trump is still overseas. And, they're talking impeachment back here. They're talking, there's investigations going on. But I don't know if this, but Trump knows how to change a narrative. And he's changed the narrative big time because he's over there. Making a fool out of himself, probably. And some people are saying, well, he's doing a good job, you know. But get out of the country because of this investigation coming up, because these people are going to be on Capitol Hill spilling their guts out. So he got out of the country to do good things over there so they won't throw his ass out over here. But he's got a budget. I mean, his budget for America is not going to stick. I just don't think it's going to stick. I mean, it is. I've heard that it was dead on arrival, but gosh, he's cutting Social Security, Medicare. There's nothing. And a lot of the money, a lot of these cuts are just tax cuts for the rich. He's trying to get money to build his wall. He's trying to get money to rev up the military by starving people. And his budget, the spokesman, this guy is a mess. Well, we're not trying to starve grandma. That's exactly what you're doing, starving grandma and granddaddy and their grandchildren. It's not good when Republicans run everything. It's not good, and America is seeing that right now. That's why I know in 2018, we are going to go to the polls and vote these scoundrels out on their butts. Because that is the only way that we're going to get this country back and back on this footing. Excuse me, back on this footing. Something is wrong. I have a sore throat or something. Yeah, I'm doing this show with a sore throat this time. Something in my throat anyway. So if I don't sound as, what's the word? If I don't sound as light or as positive or as fun, it's because my throat is hurting. I guess it happens. It's probably the weather, because it's raining, it's gray, it's cloudy, it's cold, the wind is blowing, you know, and maybe that's what it is, because I'm, like I said before, I'm in my studio and we have the big old window in front of me, and I'm looking at gray skies, rain and gloom, and somehow it's trickled down to me personally. It's a type of weather, and this is the type of weather that we're having in Chicago, where you don't do anything. You just relax, watch TV, lay down, go to sleep or something, or, you know, what do you, no outside. You can't go outside because the weather is too unseasonably. Unless you have to be out there, you're working, you're going to school. But for as entertainment thing, it's not good to be out there. It's raining, it's windy, it's blowing, you know, so the best place for you would be in your own home. Once you get off work, once you get out of school, I mean, there's no going out riding a bike, jogging, or just walking the neighborhood, having fun, getting a little bit of exercise. You have to do it in the house. But this is spring, soon to be summer. You know, and it feels like nothing out here. You know, we're not freezing to death, but it's not just Chicago. It's just about everywhere in the United States, from what I'm hearing from Facebook friends anyway. And we just have to wait till the weather gets better. That's all. That's it, at least in the city of Chicago. And I always hope that it's great weather where you are. Always hope that. Even if it's bad weather here, I'm always hoping wherever you are that the weather is fine and you're getting out and enjoying nature, exercising. Because, you know, a body, if I can talk about exercise for a little bit, your body, my body, was never made to sit. A body is not made to sit. Your body is made to move. That's why so many personal trainers and exercise gurus around the world is saying that your body is made to move. Whether you walk, jog, or whatever, you have to move to get that blood circulating between those bones. The more that blood is circulating between your bones and your calves, it's like lubrication. And I want to say this. As you age, some people think that aging means you're going to have a lot of pain in your limbs or your joints. That's not true. Aging does not mean that you have to hurt. Oh, I got a pain here. Oh, you just turned 65. No. Oh, I got a pain there. Oh, you just turned 70. Oh, I got a pain here. You just turned 45. No, it doesn't work like that. No matter how old you get, it doesn't matter. You could be 105. You do not have to hurt. The pain only comes if you're not doing the right thing when it comes to moving your body. Now, if you are sedentary, you're sitting on a couch every day watching TV, glutting down beer or Coke or popcorn, and criticizing everything and everybody that walks through the door that you see on television or the internet, you just sit around and gaining weight, of course, you're going to ache. You're going to ache. You're going to hurt because you're not, your blood is not circulating. And when you don't exercise, there's always a possibility of falls. You could fall and hurt yourself. So I want to say this again. Your body is made to move, not to sit. You know, even if you have an office job and you're sitting at your desk for 8 hours a day, that's a no-no. You have to get up every now and then, away from that desk, away from that computer, away from that bowl of candy that's sitting on your desk, and you have to at least move for 15 or 20 minutes or something and then go back and sit down and do your work. Because, you know, that's the way it was for me when I was when I worked in an office setting. You know, I had my desk, I had everything there, computer, printer, you name it, it was all there. And a lot of work, stacks of work on the desk for George. But I never sat down a straight 4 hours or a straight 8 hours. I always, in between all of that, you know, I was up and about moving around in and out of the office. And, you know, people were saying, wow, look at George. Oh, George is moving. Yeah, you're like, yeah, well, yeah, I know, because George is getting older and George don't want to hurt. And George needs to exercise, you know, and that goes for everybody. You know, I mean, if you don't remember anything or take anything from this, just remember that but your body is not supposed to sit all day or be sedentary. Your body is made to move. You don't move. You don't exercise. You are susceptible to cancer, diabetes, heart disease, you name it, joint pain, you name it. You name it. Exercise, eating right, exercise, you will live longer. You want to stay around and see your kids, your children, your grandchildren, your great-great-great-grandchildren, then you have to start taking care of yourself from the very beginning. Very beginning. If you can walk, and then you got some people who are sedentary because they have no other choice but to be sedentary. But if you can get up and walk, then walk at least for 30 minutes to an hour a day, every day. And as you get older, exercise is more and more important, because it can stop a lot of things from happening. It can stop you from tripping and falling, because you'll be able to balance yourself. You'll be able to balance yourself. Okay. All right. Walking is very important. You don't have to get out here and jog and like you see a lot of people do. They do it because that's what they want to do. If they decided they just wanted to walk, it would be just as much beneficial as jogging. So don't think that you have to get out here and jog, you know, around the corner 30 times. It, you know, if you can't do it, you can't do it, and don't do it. You can walk, because walking can trim your waistline. Walking can improve your heartbeat. Walking can reduce arthritis pain. And that's another thing I want to say. When you are in pain, still exercise. Because, you know, try to exercise through the pain. Because once you exercise through the pain will subside. You don't always need to go to the doctor and have him write you a prescription. You don't have to always go to the drugstore and get pain medication. You don't really need that stuff if you just take care of your body and just walk. Walking improves your mental attitude, of course. It manages your high blood pressure, helps manage type 2 diabetes. Okay, just walking. You don't have to, you do not have to go and get one of those high-priced gym memberships at some damn gym. You don't have to do that unless you want to do it. It's up to you. But why not walk around your neighborhood? You know, meet your neighbors or whatever, or just enjoy nature and getting exercise in all at the same time. Walking, exercise, strong bones. It's like I've just said, strong bones. And another thing, if you're walking outside and the sun is shining, hey, you're getting your vitamin D from the sun rays. Okay, so it's a lot of benefits from exercising instead of being sedentary. Your body is not supposed to sit. Okay. Okay, for some of you girls out there, walking women can reduce the size of your buttocks. Okay, it can reduce that body fat. Body fat increase your lifespan. You'll live longer. It reduces stress. It's good for your brain. You know, you can, I mean, especially it's good for, let's say if you're an author and a writer, I mean, you'd be able to write your ass off once you've gotten your hours worth of exercise in and you're feeling better. You drink your water, your blood is circulating, your heart is calmed down. You're into that recovery mode. You'll be able to think clearer. You'll be able to come up with more ideas. Exercise is great, folks. Boost your immune system. Okay? It's a great thing. And exercise can help prevent, as I've said before, I think twice, exercise can help prevent falling in older people. It gives you time to think, of course. You just don't know how many times I've just walked around my neighborhood with a pencil and a pad and come up with ideas to put into my books, my ebooks, and my stories. I come up with more ideas, original ideas, when I'm out and about around my neighborhood, enjoying nature, getting exercise, and jotting down ideas to put into something that I'm creating. It's great. And exercise is good for someone who is a creator because exercise will keep your mind strong, your brain strong in order for you to actually create. So you guys get out there and you do that exercise. Okay. Exercise lets you meditate. You are supposed to walk. Get your juices, get your creative juices going, as I've just said. Wow, improves your outlook on life. Yeah, I mean, when you exercise and you're feeling good, everybody who passes you by, you're going to smile at them. You're going to speak at them. You're going to speak. Let me say that again. You're going to smile. You're going to speak. Everybody's going to, you're going to be nice and friendly and all this kind of thing because exercise is about that. It's about making you feel good about yourself, making you feel good about what you have, even if you don't have much. And friends, family, it's just such an enjoyable time when you exercise with your friends and you exercise by yourself. Maybe you don't want to walk by yourself. Then find you someone that you can walk with that shares your ideas when it comes to keeping your body and heart healthy. Exercise also tones your entire body, improves your memory, improves your lungs. It is phenomenal, and it's free. You don't have to pay for it. You can keep yourself healthy, you know. increasing your body dexterity, make you look younger. We all want to look younger, no matter how old we get, but we all want to look younger, and exercise is one of the things, or maybe the thing, that can make you look younger, make you look younger, make you feel younger. Okay, all righty, improves your blood flow. I've said that several times. You know, you have to get that blood circulating. That will stop all that joint pain, headache pain. You have to remember, when you go to the doctor, one of the first things that doctor gonna want to do is say, hey, wow, you got high blood pressure. Let me write you this script. Let me write you this prescription. You've got type 2 diabetes. You need this medicine. Let me write it. You know, they're going to be writing you prescriptions. And a lot of doctors, let me say this, a lot of doctors aren't going to tell you everything you need to know about whatever they say you have. So if your doctor doesn't tell you everything that you need to know about something that's bothering you, you better go find out yourself, because the medical industry is all about profit. I've said this 1,000 times. They are about making money for themselves, not you. They're using you to make money, especially if you're a patient. If you're a patient, I mean, you've got millions and millions of people in the United States suffering from diabetes. When diabetes is curable, why is that? Because these doctors and clinics and hospitals, they don't want you to get well, because they want to continue writing those prescriptions, because writing those prescriptions, it's putting money in their pocket. Keeping you sick is a billion-dollar industry. Keeping you sick. And that's what they do. They keep you sick. I mean, you go get some of these prescription drugs, these drugs will kill you alone. I mean, you go get you some diabetes drugs. I mean, hey, wow. It spikes, some of that stuff can spike your sugar more than anything. Diabetes totally is curable. Nobody has to walk. Nobody has to have it. But I understand that some people with diabetes, you know, they can't handle it. If you can't handle diabetes, you're in trouble. You can handle it. You can manage it. A lot of people get caught because they can't manage it or won't manage it. And then they end up succumbing to it, dying from it. Just as cancer. You know, I mean, if you don't manage it, you don't treat it, you don't do nothing for it, you're gone. But I've heard so many people say, well, diabetes is not a death sentence. Cancer is not a death sentence. Heart disease is not a death sentence. Just because someone has these diseases doesn't mean they're going to die. And then again, if you don't do something such as treatment, you can die. If you're not monitoring it, you can die. There have been so many people out here who have been diagnosed with cancer. They've been given a few months to live. Those same people are still alive today, and they have, from that point, they told that they had cancer and given a few months to live. That was 10, 20, 30 years ago, and a lot of those people are still here. You know, they're still here. But what I really want to say is the medical industry will keep you on all kinds of medication that is no good for you. You should not be taking it. You wind up mortgaging your home, selling your car, you're soon to be out on the street because you're trying to pay for your treatments that you really don't have to pay for. You know, some people get so far A lot of people don't know that they don't have to buy a lot of these drugs, prescriptions. They don't know that. They don't know that cancer is curable. Of course it is. Of course it is. It's but I can, even if you are far advanced in cancer, these people can cure you from cancer. They say, well, we can't, well, we caught it too late. That's a bunch of bull. It doesn't matter how late it is. They can cure it if they want. The reason why they don't cure your cancer, because you may not be a millionaire or a billionaire. You may not be widely known. And they may just want to keep you on medication. These people know who they want to cure cancer for, and they know who they do not want to cure cancer for. Most of the people who die from cancer, they're poor. They ain't got no money. Nobody knows them. They're not recognizable. They're just a bunch of nobodies. And they die from cancer. Roger Moore, the James Bond character who passed away, he died from cancer. From my understanding, it's cancer that was, he had just gotten cancer, an early sign of cancer, from my understanding. But he was 89 years old. But the thing is, a lot of these diseases that they say are not curable, they are curable, but they don't want you to know that. Some of these doctors don't want you to know that your best medicine is exercise and eating right. Those are your medicines. Eating right and exercising, watching what you put in your mouth. I told my son the other day, I said, food can kill you. I don't think he cared because he just stuffs it down. But I said, one of the number one things that can kill you is food. Totally, totally, it's food. Soda pop, sugar. I said, man, you eat all these donuts and you eat all these cakes and sweets. Don't you ever think about getting diabetes? No. You may be young now, but in your... as you get older, you may, you know, start to have some symptoms of diabetes because, you know, it happens to everybody. And another thing is you don't have to be obese or overweight to be diagnosed with diabetes. There's some people out here who are skinnier than a rail and are diabetic. And are diabetics, if I can say it. You know, how did I get on this diatribe here? Anyway, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio, straight out of the city of Chicago. It is dark, gray, and rainy, and cold, and everything else. You really can't call this spring, but, you know, it's better than, you know, 20 below zero, I guess. And, here's a little bit more about diabetes. This is a clip.
I have the best job in the world. I'm a doctor. No, believe me, that's not why. I'm an obesity doctor. I have the honor of working with a group of people subject to the last widely accepted prejudice. Being fat. These people have suffered a lot by the time they see me. Shame, guilt, blame, and outright discrimination. The attitude that many take, including those in healthcare, is that these people are to blame for their situation. If they could just control themselves, they wouldn't be overweight, and they're not motivated to change. Please let me tell you, this is not the case. The blame, if we've got to extend some here, has been with our advice And it's time we change that. Obesity is a disease. It's not something created by lack of character. It's a hormonal disease. And there are many hormones involved, and one of the main ones is a hormone called insulin. Most obese individuals are resistant to this hormone, insulin. So what does that mean exactly, to be resistant to insulin? Well, insulin resistance is essentially a state of type 2 diabetes. Insulin's job is to drive glucose or blood sugar into the cells where it can be used. In a nutshell, when someone is insulin resistant, they're having trouble getting blood sugar where it needs to go, into those cells. And it just can't hang out in the blood after we eat, or we would all have a diabetic crisis after every meal. So when someone is resistant to insulin, the body's response to this is to just make more of it. And insulin levels will rise and rise, and for a while, years even, this is going to keep up, and blood sugar levels can remain normal. However, usually it can't keep up forever. And even at those elevated levels of insulin are not enough to keep blood sugar in the normal range. So it starts to rise. That's diabetes. It probably won't surprise you to hear that most of my patients have insulin resistance or diabetes. And if you're sitting there thinking, that's not me, you actually might want to think again, because almost 50% of adult Americans now have diabetes or prediabetes. That is almost 120 million of us. But that's hardly everyone who has issues with insulin, because as I was saying, people have elevated insulin levels due to insulin resistance for years, even decades before the diagnosis of even prediabetes is made. Plus, it's been shown that 16 to 25% of normal weight adults are also insulin resistant. So in case you're keeping track, this is a heck of a lot of us. So the trouble with insulin resistance is, if it goes up, we are at great risk for developing type 2 diabetes. But also, insulin makes us hungry, and the food we eat much more likely to be stored as fat. Insulin is our fat storage hormone. So we can start to see how it's going to be a problem for diseases like obesity and metabolic issues like diabetes. But what if we trace this problem back to the beginning and we just didn't have so much glucose around that insulin needed to deal with? Let's take a look at how that could be. Everything you eat is either a carbohydrate, a protein, or a fat, and they all have a very different effect on glucose and therefore insulin levels, as you can see on the graph. So when we eat carbohydrates, our insulin and glucose are going to spike up fast. And with proteins, it looks a lot better. But take a look at what happens when we eat fat. Essentially nothing, a flat line. And this is going to wind up being very important. So now I want to translate that graph for you into a real-world situation. I want you to go back and think about the last time you ate an American version of Chinese food. We all know there's rules associated with this, right? And the first rule is you're going to overeat, because the stop signal doesn't get sent until you are literally busting at the seams. Rule number two is, in an hour, you're starving. Why? Well, because the rice in that meal caused glucose and insulin to skyrocket, which triggered hunger, fat storage, and cravings. So, if you're insulin resistant to begin with, and your insulin levels are already higher, you really are hungrier all the time. And we have this set up. Eat carbs, your glucose goes up, your insulin goes up, and you have hunger and fat storage. So how do we recommend to these people to eat? Because it seems like that would be really important, and it is. Let's focus just on type 2 diabetes, because the general recommendations are to tell patients with type 2 diabetes to consume 40 to 65 grams of carbohydrates per meal, plus more at snacks. Trust me on this, that's a lot of carbs. And remember what's going to happen to glucose and insulin, blood sugar and insulin, when we eat them? Yes, we are essentially recommending that they eat exactly what's causing their problem. Sound crazy? It really, really is. Because at its root, diabetes is a state of carbohydrate toxicity. We can't get the blood sugar into the cells, and that causes a problem in the short term, but the long-term consequences are even greater. And insulin resistance is essentially a state of carbohydrate intolerance. So why, oh why, do we want to continue to recommend to people to eat them? The American Diabetes Association guidelines specifically state that there is inconclusive evidence to recommend a specific carbohydrate limit. But those guidelines go right on to say what we all know. Carbohydrate intake is the single biggest factor in blood sugar levels and therefore need for medication. These guidelines then go on to say, hey, look, if you're taking certain diabetic medications, you actually have to eat carbs. Otherwise, your blood sugar can go too low. Okay, so let's take a look at the vicious cycle that advice just set up. So it's eat carbs, so you have to take medicine. Then you have to eat more carbs so you avoid the side effect of those medications. And around we go. Even worse is that nowhere in the ADA guidelines is the goal of reversing type 2 diabetes. This needs to be changed because type 2 diabetes can be reversed in many, if not most, situations, especially if we start early. Not only do we need to let people know this, but we have to start giving them the practical advice so they can do this. Consider carbs. First, here's a shocker for you. We don't need them. Seriously, our minimum daily requirement for carbohydrates is zero. We have essential amino acids, those are proteins, essential fatty acids, but nope, no essential carb. A nutrient is essential if we have to have it to function, and we can't make it from something else. We make glucose, plenty of it, all the time. It's called gluconeogenesis. So, we don't need them. The overconsumption of them is making us very sick. Yet we are continuing to recommend to patients to consume close to, if not more, than half of their total energy intake every day from them. It doesn't make sense. Let's talk about what does. Cutting carbs a lot. Yes, in my clinic, we teach patients to eat with carbs as the minority of their intake, not the majority. So how does that work? Well, when our patients decrease their carbs, their glucose goes down, and they don't need as much insulin. So those insulin levels drop, and fast. And this is very important because a study looking at our National Health and Nutrition Examination survey data, better known as NHANES, showed that the single biggest risk factor for coronary artery disease is insulin resistance. It is responsible for a whopping 42% of heart attacks. Low-carb intervention works so fast that we can literally pull people off of hundreds of units of insulin in days to weeks. One of my favorite stories is a very recent one. A young gal, but who had an almost 20-year history of type 2 diabetes, came in when a physician from another clinic told her she was just sick and should probably get used to it. Her diabetes was way out of control. This despite the fact that she was on multiple medications, including almost 300 units of insulin that was being injected into her continuously every day via a pump. All of this, remember, blood sugar still out of control. So we put her on a low-carb diet, and now let's fast forward 4 months. She lost weight, yes, but better than that, sick no more. Her blood sugar levels were now normal all of the time. This on, get this, no diabetes medication. Gone was the 300 units of insulin, no more insulin pump, no more pricking her finger multiple times each day, gone, all of it. No more diabetes. One of the greatest joys of my job is to be able to tell a patient like this that they no longer have diabetes, and we ceremoniously take it off their problem list together. So, are they cured? Is this a miracle? We'll leave that grandstanding to Dr. Oz. Cured would imply that it can't come back. And if they start eating excessive carbs again, it will. So no, not cured, but they don't have diabetes any longer. It's resolved. And it can stay that way as long as we keep away the cause. So what does this look like then? How does somebody eat this way? Well, first let me tell you what it's not. Low carb is not zero carb, and it is not high protein. These are common criticisms that are so frustrating because they're not true. Next, if we take the carbs out, what are we going to put in? Because remember, there's only three macronutrients. If one goes down, one has to go up. My patients eat fat and a lot of it. What, you say? I mean, what's going to happen when you eat fat? Well, let me tell you, you're going to be happy because fat tastes great and it is incredibly satisfying. But remember, fat is the only macronutrient that's going to keep our glucose, blood sugar, and insulin levels low, and that is so important. So I want you to now hear my simple rules for eating. These rules, you have to remember, are even going to be more important if you are one of the tens of millions of Americans who have trouble with insulin levels. Rule number one, if it says light, low fat, or fat-free, stays in the grocery store, because if they took the fat out, they put carbs and chemicals in. Rule number two, eat food. The most important rule in low-carb nutrition. Real food does not come in a box, and no one should have to tell you real food is natural. You should know that when you look at it. Don't eat anything you don't like. And eat when you're hungry, don't eat when you're not, no matter what the clock says. And number five is a simple way to remember what we want to avoid. No GPS. No grains, no potatoes, and no sugar. That last one is a biggie, right? No grains? Yeah, no grains. But we have to have them. Nope, they're a carb. But whole grains are so good for us. Well, first of all, there are actually very few foods out there that are truly whole grain, even when they say they are. Most foods that purport themselves to be whole grain are highly processed and the fiber benefit ruined. Or they're coming with highly refined flour, usually both of these things. So if you are one of the truly insulin-sensitive people, you can eat real whole grain. But if you are in the enormous slice of our population with insulin issues, it's making things worse. So what if you are one of the real insulin-sensitive people? Can you still eat this way? Yes. I'm a great example. Over a year ago, I decided I would cut my carbs as low as I recommend to my diabetic patients. Now, it's not mandatory for my health like it is for theirs. I'm not insulin resistant, so would this be a problem? No, that's just the thing. Unless you have an exceedingly rare syndrome, then cutting carbs is going to be good for you, even if it's not necessary. I want to show you a couple pictures of my radical food. So this is a common breakfast in my house. So does it look like I just broke my own rule? I didn't, because this muffin is made with coconut flour. I bake all the time still. I just use non-grain-based flours. Coconut, almond, hazelnut, flax, they make delicious things. And this is a typical dinner in my house with a typical starch. That would be the sautéed mushrooms. Now, my patients and I eat delightful food all of the time and enjoy it. But what about the research on this? I mean, is this just anecdotal evidence now from my clinic? No. There are dozens of randomized controlled trials looking at low-carb intervention for things like diabetes, cardiovascular risk factors, obesity. They're consistent. It works. There are even a large number of studies showing that low-carb nutrition decreases inflammatory markers, which is making it really exciting for diseases like cancer. We just finished a study in our clinic, and what we did is we took 50 type 2 diabetic patients that were treated with our low-carb, high-fat-based program, and we compared them to 50 patients who were treated with the ADA guidelines. And after 6 months, not only did we find a significant metabolic advantage for the low-carb group, but, and let's face it, this is important, a huge cost savings. Our analysis showed that our patients could save over $2,000 a year just on the diabetes meds they were no longer taking. Just think how fast that adds up in our diabetes epidemic now that we are spending $250 billion a year on in this country. So I want to show you a slide now that demonstrates where that savings is coming from. So this is looking just at the insulin difference in the two groups after 6 months. And what we can see is that the low-carb group was able to decrease their insulin by almost 500 units a day, whereas in the ADA-treated group, they had to increase their insulin by almost 350 units a day. Two important things. Number one, insulin's expensive. And number two, not all the people in this study were even on insulin, which makes these results even more impressive. But what I would say is that this graph really represents two different approaches to treating this disease. The first, our group with the goal of reversing disease, meaning they need less medicine. And the second group, which very clearly aligns with the ADA guidelines, which states that diabetes is a progressive disease requiring more medicine over time. Progressive, unless we take away the cause. So what's the problem then? Why is this not everywhere? Why isn't low-carb the norm? There's two big reasons. Number one, status quo. It is hard to break. There are many agendas involved. We got this notion that low-fat was the way to go decades ago, but a recent study just came out showing that there was zero randomized control evidence to recommend to Americans to remove the fat from our diet, and that's how the carbs got added in. It was essentially a huge experiment on millions of people, and it failed miserably. The second reason we don't see it everywhere is money. Don't be fooled. There's a lot of money to be made from keeping you sick. And what we see is with these specialty guideline panels, they are stacked with conflict of interest. So the solution to the diabetes epidemic in my clinic is exceedingly clear. Stop using medicine to treat food. And for a disease whose root cause is carbohydrates, take away the carbohydrates, or at least cut them, so we can remember what we used to know. We knew it a long time ago. This was said thousands of years ago, and we need, in this day and age, to get back to that notion. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the George Wilder Jr. Show has now arrived. Thank you.
Do blacks commit more crimes than other races? The simple answer to this question is yes. The black population of the United States is approximately 13%, and the white population is approximately 62%. These are the FBI crime statistics for 2014, where blacks accounted for 27.8% of the total amount of arrests for that year, an obviously disproportionate amount for a population of 13%. The overall level of arrests for black people is higher than might be expected in almost every category, except for driving under the influence of alcohol. Black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder, 51.3%, robbery, 55.9%, and gambling, 58.9%. They were also significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes, 40.7%, prostitution and commercialized vice, 41.8%, and aggravated assault, 33.1%. A common criticism of these figures is that they are based on arrests by police officers who may be disproportionately targeting black neighborhoods due to racial bias or profiling. However, these statistics seem to be corroborated by the National Crime Victimization Surveys performed by the Department of Justice. The latest NCVS data is from 2008 and is collected by a random survey of 90,000 households. Blacks are consistently disproportionately represented in these surveys, correlating closely with the arrest figures. In addition to this, the number of black police officers has remained steady since 2007 at 12%, while being 13% of the population. There has been a marked rise in non-black ethnic minority officers, but despite police efforts, recruiting blacks into the police force has been challenging due to criminal background checks and a cultural attitude towards the police as an institution. Naturally, murder and non-negligent manslaughter is the category missing from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and it is also the most focused on by the media. Homicides by victim and perpetrator are often presented as percentages as victim and perpetrator by race, which gives a chart that looks like this. Most murders are committed by a perpetrator of the same race as the victim. This obfuscates the severity of the problem by making the number of murders look evenly spread between both racial categories, with a small crossover of black-on-white or white-on-black crime. However, displaying the number of murders brings the issue of disproportionate violence committed by black people into focus. When someone says, "Black lives don't matter" to "Black lives matter," this is what they mean. Black men are responsible for murdering other black men at a rate that is near parity with the murders of white men by other white men, when white men are 5 times as numerous as black men. These murders are usually committed with a handgun. So the question becomes, why? As Aristotle said in Politics, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. There are many studies that positively correlate poverty with non-violent and violent crime, but I've chosen to use the Edinburgh Study of Youth Transitions and Crime performed by researchers from the University of Edinburgh. I've used this study because the black population of Edinburgh is approximately 1%, and the United Kingdom is a modern, industrialized, English-speaking, Christian heritage, first world democracy. This study has been done predominantly on white British people, and I want to showcase this to demonstrate that poverty has a distinct effect on people regardless of any inherent biological differences, and to remove the possibility that these results are due to racial discrimination. The Edinburgh study followed the lives of around 4,000 young people as they made the transition from childhood to adulthood, using both self-reported data from the young people themselves and linked data from a range of official sources. The researchers studied the effect of childhood poverty on violence in the teenage years, and examined its impact beyond into early adulthood. The researchers have set out 4 measures of poverty: socioeconomic status of the head of the household, whether the young person was not in education, training, or employment at age 18, whether the young person has been unemployed for more than a year at age 22, neighborhood deprivation based on census measures of poverty in the young person's area of residence. The study found that poverty had a significant and direct effect on young people's likelihood to engage in violence at age 15, even after controlling for the effects of a range of other factors known to influence violent behavior, even when taking into account of a raft of risk indicators that would be expected to increase the propensity to engage in violence, including poor family functioning, the lack of attachment to school, substance misuse and impulsivity, and a range of protective factors that are known to act as preventatives, such as a strong and positive relationship with the parents. young people who were living in a family where the head of the household was unemployed or in low status manual employment, and those who were growing up in communities with high levels of deprivation were significantly more likely to engage in violence. Household poverty appears to act as an exacerbating factor and increases the chance of such young people offending. The Edinburgh study provides evidence that children living in poverty are overrepresented among violent offenders. Even taking account of this increased risk of offending, however, children from poor backgrounds are disproportionately selected into the juvenile justice system and retained there by decision-making that is based on, amongst other things, their impoverished status. Previous work has shown that this type of systemic processing labels and marginalizes the most vulnerable young people in society, making it difficult for them to move on from offending as they mature. The system causes structural failures that prevent those in poverty from moving out of this condition, and in the longer term, this constrains opportunities and reduces life chances. As Aristotle recognized more than 2,000 years ago, poverty breeds criminal behavior. The Edinburgh study came to an interesting conclusion as to why this behavior would involve violence. For most young people, from the most impoverished backgrounds, violence provides a touchstone against which identities are honed. More particularly, violence empowers and is a means of attaining and sustaining status among peers. Willingness to use violence, therefore, becomes a resource for the most dispossessed, and this becomes a persistent feature throughout the teenage years. It follows that poverty will create increased levels of non-violent crime, such as theft, burglary, or drug dealing. But in the absence of available wealth as a status symbol, impoverished young people use capacity for violence instead. According to Pew Research Center data from 2013, black children are 27.3% of the black population, but 38.4% of those living in poverty. US Census Bureau data from 2014 shows that while overall, 18% of families in the US with children under 18 live in poverty, this number rises to 32.1% for black families. The poverty rate for black families with intact marriages drops to 10.8%, but rises dramatically in cases of unmarried single parents. 31.2% of single fathers with children under 18 are impoverished, as are 46.1% of single mothers with children under 18. These figures follow the trend of economic hardship for single parents throughout the rest of the United States, albeit slightly more exaggerated. This has resulted in the black children living in poverty outnumbering white children living in poverty, in spite of white children outnumbering black children by 3-1. US Census Bureau data shows that over half of black children do not live with their biological fathers. Unmarried black mothers with children under 18 are the most impoverished demographic in American society, and they are the most common type of family structure in black communities. A 2005 study from the University of California called The Effects of Poverty and Economic Hardship Across the Generations found that economic pressure appears to be the key mechanism linking hardship to a cascade of effects on children's development. The distress caused by poverty seems to predict lower positive, i.e. self-confidence, good school performance, supportive relationship with peers, and higher negative child outcomes, i.e. antisocial behavior, depressed mood, and symptoms of anxiety. In contrast, higher family income and the investment in children's development appear to have beneficial influences on long-term developmental success. Taken together, the family stress model and investment model suggest an intergenerational transmission of poverty and economic hardship. The family stress model of economic hardship proposes that financial difficulties have an adverse effect on parents' emotions, behaviors, and relationships, which affect their parenting or socialization strategies. According to the model, the emotional distress of poverty predicts conflict and reduces warmth and support in parent-child relationships. These relationship disruptions contribute to children's emotional and behavioral problems, academic failures, and poor cognitive functioning. The investment model suggests that economic resources increase the investment parents are able to make in their children's development, promoting academic and social competencies. With increased resources, parents are able to invest in the development of their children, providing the special care, time, and services necessary to support their children's emotional needs. These investments contribute to enriched learning environments, higher standards of living, and safer homes and neighborhoods. Greater family resources appear to reduce risks associated with the stress of poverty and help create environments that promote competent development. Instability is another key factor in the emotional well-being and intellectual growth of a child. A 2013 study called The Negative Effects of Instability on Child Development, a Research Synthesis, describes the effects of poverty and instability. Children thrive in stable and nurturing environments, where they have a routine and know what to expect. Although some change in children's lives is normal and anticipated, sudden and dramatic disruptions can be extremely stressful and affect children's feeling of security. Within the context of supportive relationships with adults who act as a buffer against any negative effects of instability, children learn how to cope with adversity, adapt to their surroundings, and regulate their emotions. When parents lack choice or control over change, they may be less likely to support their children in adapting to the change. Unbuffered stress that escalates to extreme levels can be detrimental to children's mental health and cognitive functioning. The experience of economic instability causes increased material hardship, particularly when families lack personal assets. Low family income negatively affects children's social, emotional, cognitive, and academic outcomes, even after controlling for parental characteristics. Children's cognitive development during early childhood is most sensitive to the experience of low family income. Parental employment instability is linked to negative academic outcomes, such as grade retention, lower educational attainment, and internalized and externalizing behaviors. The effect on grade retention is strongest for children with parents in a high school education or less, whereas the effect on educational attainment is stronger for blacks than whites, males, and firstborn children. In dual-income households, the father's job loss might be more strongly related to children's academic outcomes than the mother's job loss. Job instability leads to worse child behavioral outcomes than when a parent voluntarily changes jobs, works low-wage jobs full-time, or has fluctuating work hours. Family instability is linked to problem behaviors and some academic outcomes, even at early ages. Children's problem behaviors further increase with multiple changes in family structure. Family transitions that occur early in children's development, prior to age 6, and in adolescence, appear to have the strongest effects. While young children need constant caregivers with whom they can form secure attachments, adolescents need parental support, role models, and continuity of residence and schools to succeed. Children demonstrate more negative behaviors when they lack the emotional and material support at home that they need to smoothly handle a family transition. Poverty is bad for children's emotional and cognitive development, and poverty is more likely to be the consequence of single-parent households. The next factor to consider is the subculture many of these young people are inculcated into. It should be no surprise that large numbers of delinquent, impoverished young men, with poor education and lacking in fatherly role models, would find acceptance within criminal gangs. In 2012, it was estimated that there were 30,000 gangs operating within the United States, with over 800,000 members. Blacks make up over 35% of these gangs, while whites make up less than 12%. These gangs are, of course, predominantly young men, and they are mostly located in large cities. Gang violence accounts for a hugely disproportionate amount of violent crime. Gangs are responsible for an average of 48% of violent crime in most jurisdictions, and up to 90% in several others. Major cities and suburban areas experience the most gang-related violence. Local, neighborhood-based gangs and drug crews continue to pose the most significant criminal threat in most communities. Aggressive recruitment of juveniles and immigrants, alliances and conflict between gangs, the release of incarcerated gang members from prison, advancements in technology and communication, and Mexican drug trafficking organization involvement in drug distribution have resulted in gang expansion and violence in a number of jurisdictions. As covered earlier, black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder at 51.3%, robbery at 55.9%, and gambling at 58.9%, and were significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes at 40.7%, prostitution and vice at 41.8%, and aggravated assault at 33.1%. These are all common gang activities, and are without a doubt raising the resulting statistics for black crime. You may have noticed that the statistics for black crime have often been juxtaposed against Hispanic crime, with Hispanics having a higher rate of poverty and criminal gang membership, but a lower propensity for violence. I think this can be adequately explained by a lower rate of single-parent families, 31.2%, and a strong cultural tradition of deep familial ties, but I do not have any data or studies to validate this. So, why do black people commit more crimes? To be specific, young black men commit more crimes, far more, than any other racial demographic. They are much more likely to come from an unstable, impoverished, single-parent, matriarchal household. They are more likely than young white men to lack a strong male role model. They are much more likely to seek acceptance in gang culture, leading to the acquisition of a criminal record, reducing employment prospects, and putting the individual into a downward spiral of poverty, which further incentivizes criminal behavior as a source of income. If you don't mind me speaking in more generalized terms and giving my opinions on the matter, it seems to me that these people are victims of circumstance. For many black men, the deck has already been stacked against them from their earliest days. They suffer from many societal handicaps that are beyond their control that directly affect their cognitive abilities and emotional well-being, and find themselves with reduced options from social stigma attached to poverty before any other factors need to be introduced. So I know what you're thinking. This is the white man's fault, isn't it? And the answer is no. There is no one group at which the finger can be pointed with any reliability to say, you did this. If I may conjecture, I think the fact that black people can be visually distinguished from white people has provided an intellectually lazy trap in which it's...
Alrighty. All right, welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Hope you enjoyed that little bit from England. All right, calculating or naive. This is a photograph I'm looking at Trump on CNN, and it says Trump may have nothing to hide. So why is he acting like he does? He sure does. Trump just spilled the beans on himself, you know. So he's, I don't know. What's going to happen? I do know that they're holding hearings now. I think Comey postponed his hearing. I don't know what's going to happen to Trump, whether he be impeached or not, or censored or not, or I have no clue. But before he went overseas, I had a feeling that he probably was going to be impeached for obstructing an investigation, and he's done it 3 or 4 times over already. There's different rules for Trump, and there's rules for the rest of us. All right, you can follow me on Facebook, follow me on right here, follow me, click follow on right here on Black Talk Radio. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, I'm all over the place. Very, very active. I've been very active in this thing for a long time. Trump's got a budget out here, folks, and it's horrendous. His budget director is like 2 + 2 = 7 when it comes to Trump's budget. Nobody agrees to those numbers but the Trump people. Sensible, intelligent people, bright people, level-headed people saying this is garbage. But Trump and his team are saying this is the best thing that ever happened to the United States. Cutting people off food stamps, cutting Medicaid, cutting this, cutting that, seniors, disabled, and they call this a good thing. The only reason why they're cutting, it's for the rich, tax cuts for the rich, and it's for the pay for his wall and to boost the military on the backs of the poor, on the backs of the middle class. These people don't give two shits about what's going on out here in the world, about real people. And the thing about it, Trump is this proposed budget of his probably won't pass. I'm hearing it's DOA on arrival, but the gall that he had putting this thing through with his lying ass budget directors, trying to make us swallow BS when we don't have to, when we know better. Stay tuned, folks. This is going to be get a lot better as it goes along. Trump is still overseas, and we'll see what's going to happen when he gets back. I have a feeling nothing's going to happen. I have a feeling that he really wants to be president. I don't think he's going to resign, because he looks to he's trying to be presidential. Trump is actually trying to be presidential, and it's not working because being presidential is not being Donald Trump for some reason. I mean, if you listen to his soft voice and his soft rhetoric, and he's soft, and you can immediately tell that's not Donald Trump. That's someone else. That's not Trump.
Heaven help the child who never had a home. Heaven help the girl who walks the streets alone. Heaven help the roses if the bombs begin to fall. Heaven never saw. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who's a crawl. Heaven help us all.
Everybody out there for listening it and tuning into the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thank you so much. I hope you join me tomorrow. It's going to be great fun, great guests. And just about booked up for the entire month of June. And I want to say thank everybody. Bye-bye. Take care.